Offshore wind projects on the Great Lakes have been discussed for some time now, and it looks like the first one will happen soon. It's called the Icebreaker Project. Here to tell us about the potential for wind energy on the Great Lakes is Andy Belaskovitz. He's a freelance reporter based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's got a new article in the ENSIA publication, a scientific journal of the U of M, talking about the icebreaker and offshore wind. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Andy Belaskovitz.
Thanks for having me.
Well, interesting topic, Andy, offshore wind production on the Great Lakes. So Icebreaker is the name of the project, very Bond-esque, and 8 miles off of Cleveland is the location. So just to give everyone that frame of reference, talk about offshore wind projects on the Great Lakes, a brief history, if you would.
Yeah, so around 2009 was really when there was, I would say, the most interest going on among the Great Lakes states and the opportunity for offshore wind development. A lot of that was going on in Michigan. Under a former administration, Governor Jennifer Granholm, who was a Democrat and was really really focused on clean energy and alternative energy options, set up this task force sort of that went into depth about looking at, okay, what it would take from the state's perspective to put a policy in place. At the time, it was, you know, it was you know, kind of an expensive proposition, but, you know, I think all renewable energy options at the time were kind of expensive, and so there was a lot of work going on to see how those costs could be reduced. But it wasn't just Michigan either. Ontario, Canada was looking at this, Illinois, New York. They were all sort of interested and had some ideas about, you know, what could be accomplished within the next 6 years or so. But for a variety of factors over the next few years, politics, you know, the economic competitiveness compared to other renewable options, particularly onshore wind, sort of just, you know, interest in it just kind of petered out, so to speak. But all the while, this icebreaker project had been proposed in Lake Erie. As you said, it's about eight miles offshore of Cleveland, and it kind of continued moving along. It never sort of went away. It's planned for it have remained in place. It's got some support from the federal government a few years ago to keep it moving, and now it's in a position where it's sort of kind of at the last steps of the permitting process at the state and federal level, to where the developers are now hoping to start construction around 2020.
Yeah, so there were sort of conflicting dates in my research here, where it's certainly been a work in project, and it's got a 8 or 9 year history of development, like you mentioned, since around 2009, when renewable energy became very much sought after, you know, from a policy level, a lot of solar and wind became subsidized and research. And so in 8 years of research, and quite an ambitious collaboration, it looks like, amongst both public and private money and investment, and now a firm from Norway is involved. And if you could talk about the partnerships that are in place to make this happen in the international perspective as well, Andy.
Yeah, so in the case of Icebreaker, there's the Cleveland Foundation was really instrumental in pursuing this as an economic development tool for that area. And that led to the creation of this public-private partnership called LEEDCO, the Lake Erie Energy Development Corporation, who you know, ended up finding a partner in this company, Fred Olsen Renewables, out of Norway. And you know, offshore wind is quite a bit farther along over in Europe than it is here in the States. You know, plenty of projects and demonstrations have taken place. We're starting to see the costs go down. So really ahead of the curve, much more so than we are in the United States here. It's slowly starting to build along the eastern seaboard and in the Atlantic Ocean. But projects here in the U.S. are also looking at Europe from the economic point of view and seeing how costs have continue to decline there and what that might mean for projects here in the U.S.
Okay, so offshore wind, just so everyone's clear, entirely different than these wind farms we're seeing going up in the prairies and the mountains, onshore wind. Why the sort of the preference for onshore over the last 9 years? What makes offshore more difficult?
Primarily cost. Especially here in several Midwest states, Minnesota included, around 2006, 2008, we saw states adopting these renewable portfolio standards with some targets, 10, 15, 20% renewables by certain dates. And they were relatively, ambitious at the time. Michigan's, for example, was 10% by 2015, which it hit. So states had this mandate in place where they had to get a certain amount of electricity from renewables. And it just turned out that a lot more development and experience had surrounded onshore wind. And the sort of the policy and, politics of it and the technical aspects just made it so that it developed at a quicker pace than offshore did.
All right, Dave Tirsik here on The Roadhouse talking with Andy Belaskowitz. He's a freelance reporter based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Fascinating article in this current ENSEA journal, and it's entitled, "Has the Time Finally Come for Offshore Wind Energy on the Great Lakes?" And so just with a title like that, you can tell it's been a work in progress. There's an icebreaker proposal project pretty well worked through for Cleveland, Ohio. Let's get into the nitty-gritty, Andy, as far as logistics and why Cleveland, Ohio. What became so attractive about that location?
So first off, the sort of the stakeholders that were involved there were interested in this as an economic development project. You heard the stories of Rust Belt cities, and so that's kind of where the interest really stemmed from, it as a way to sort of say, okay, could this be a way for the community to sort of boost jobs? They're talking about hundreds of jobs with this particular project. But it also has the infrastructure in a way, which is important to think about. If you think about this, the shorelines along the Great Lakes, you get a bit of variety of some very rural and scenic areas versus some of the industrial centers like Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, things like that. So, Cleveland was sort of had a mix of that going forward, and kind of made it attractive from the developer's point of view. It's also a good resource, on its own. Just a good wind resource, and its ability to get enough wind generation coming through there to make the project worthwhile.
Okay, and we're talking icebreaker project, smaller scale wind farm. Looks like 6 turbines. Is this more or less a demonstration project?
Yeah, exactly. That's really important to remember here. So 6 turbines, 20 megawatts. It's about 7,000 houses that it could power. But typical onshore projects can span dozens or over 100 turbines. And think about out in the Great Plains states. So. Yeah, it's important to keep in mind that this is a demonstration, and a lot of states and renewable energy developers, even Ontario province has been looking at this and sort of waiting for this icebreaker project to happen to really break down issues of economics, issues around wildlife, what sort of impacts it has on migratory birds and fish and things like that. So. Really, all eyes are on this project. For those excited about it, they hope that it's going to lead to a lot more development throughout the Great Lakes. Others who might be a little more skeptical are kind of concerned that this might just happen and things will kind of be stagnant again for the foreseeable future. And then, of course, you have opponents to it who sort of fear a widespread development of this, based on wildlife concerns or particularly, sort of the not in my backyard sort of aesthetic kind of aspect to these to wind projects, which is, not just unique to onshore wind, but also offshore wind.
Well, I think there's where I'd like to maybe focus the next inquiry is the benefits to offshore wind in addressing some of those concerns with aesthetics and wildlife. Is there must be some advantages to putting the turbines 8 miles offshore. Would you see them from the shoreline? I think I've saw it, Fish and Wildlife Service has a 3 mile sort of buffer around the shoreline for birds. Is there less migratory traffic 8 miles out?
Yeah, so the impact on birds issue is interesting and one that's kind of ongoing. The icebreaker developers had a consultant look into this who said the project comes with minimal risk as it relates to wildlife. Audubon Society, who's probably one of the leading advocacy groups in the U.S. for bird populations and conservation, has sort of a nuanced approach to this issue. And first of all, they say that climate change is overall a much greater threat to migratory bird populations than to any sort of wind project in and of itself. So they've kind of taken the position here that first off, some more data collection needs to be done at these areas, 8 miles out or so. And then going forward, they want to see sort of rules and regulations in place that are going to sort of regulate how data is collected based on the impact of birds. So going forward, first I have to realize that there isn't too much known quantitatively in this particular area, what's going to happen to these bird populations. So going forward, Audubon in particular advocates for a lot of high quality analysis on the data that they find.
Well, I would hope the not in my backyard crowd would see the advantage to parking these things offshore. They're certainly going to be out of sight, out of sound. There's that flicker and flutter phenomenon that's currently happening onshore. It seems like several advantages. Disadvantages, you talk about price. Is that just the extra infrastructure, laying out lines underwater, service, maintenance? What about ice? I was going to ask about this as a seasonal, when you're dealing with the Great Lakes, you're dealing with ice and wind and lots of nasty weather. Talk about the environment and how that is going to affect this.
Sure. Well, I think, on that technical side, I think, they've made great strides over the past decade or so looking at this issue of ice. And it's really not a concern, according to the developers of the Icebreaker Project. It's why it's called the Icebreaker Project, based on the type of technology they have and being able to break up the ice around it and minimize, issues that may arise, and also being able to get out there and service the turbines themselves. That it's a challenge, on the technical side, depending, if you want to go farther out into the lake, you can do that, but, it becomes more of a challenge to get out there farther and service these types of things. In a place like Lake Superior, up by where you're at, water is much colder and deeper. Some of the folks I've talked to said, that it would likely come down to using some sort of floating technology to effectively, float the turbines out there rather than drill them into the lake bed. So, different areas present their own different challenges.
So not very likely that we'll be seeing any North Shore Lake Superior development. I know you've got a fascinating map in your publication, sort of a wind map that's been generated. Where are some of the likely locations for future farms?
So, based on that map, so some of the areas where with the best resources, out in the middle of Lake Michigan, pretty much, probably midway up the lower peninsula of Michigan is a really great resource. Lake Superior between along the upper peninsula coastline by between Marquette and the Keweenaw Peninsula those are great resources, but maybe not the most likely areas that'll get developed. So when you sort of factor that in, areas looking at most likely, you know, sort of ripe for development is Lake Erie, sort of the thumb region in the lower peninsula of Michigan on the eastern side, and sort of out in the middle of Lake Michigan there are really some of the best areas and perhaps most likely to get developed down the road.
And that could be years out. It sounds like Icebreaker is going to be the pilot project demonstration, if you will, and based on its success and its scientific accumulation of data, too, I think that'll, I hope, meet a lot of folks' needs when they would like more information about this, more data on the migratory impact. But aesthetics, boy, it sure makes sense to park these things offshore. And like, I think we'd all agree that something needs to be done to reduce our carbon footprint, and certainly wind power is on the menu. So offshore wind, fascinating discussion. Andy Balaskovitz is got the article on ENSIA, E-N-S-I-A, and it's going to be linked through on this interview, Andy. So any additional resources you'd like to point out for our listeners to go to if they'd like to learn more?
The Department of Energy actually has quite a few resources online. If you just sort of look up offshore wind, Department of Energy, lots of reports and maps and graphs talking about costs and where some of the most likely areas to do this are. That's really helpful. It's also sort of been an ongoing news topic of discussion in the news in Ontario, where they've had a moratorium in place since about 2011, but some controversy surrounding that. So it's remains in the news over in Ontario.
Well, as it should, you know, good things should be talked about and discussed at length. And wind energy, certainly one of them. Thanks for your great work, Andy Balaskovitz. Thanks for joining us on The Roadhouse.